Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we have some really interesting personalities to bring to you today, starting with, go ahead, Rabbit.
Well, we've actually got two personalities in one, because we have Coleman Andrews, the founder of Savour Magazine, who's a personality in his own right.
Who's going to also let us in on a new big venture.
But that really the most important reason we invited him on the program just at this particular moment is his just released biography of Ferran Adria, which is being received with interesting press, shall we say, and was just telling me. But regardless, it's a fascinating story of a fascinating man and a fascinating transformation of the food movement. So you're going to want to know all about it.
Coleman Andrews, you're a legend, as you well know. I'm more interested in the fact, though, that you are a very elegant writer, and I enjoy your books and your writing, and I enjoyed this book, and so did Peter, Ferran, The Inside Story of El Bui and the Man Who Reinvented Food. Now, that's a major statement. So you think this man, I happen to think he did too, but let's hear your reason. What is the scope of his influence?
Well, this is a man who, as I point out in the book, at one point, probably for the rest of his life, he's going to be associated with the term molecular gastronomy.
Which he hates.
Which is a term he hates and says it doesn't really exist, and if it does exist, he had nothing to do with it. But what he did do was, he was one of those kind of rare creative types that just sort of looks at his chosen field and says, well, maybe there's other ways of doing it that haven't been done before. And he basically looked at everything in the kitchen and said, why do they tell us that in fine cooking or haute cuisine, you can't have common everyday ingredients? Why do they tell us that in cooking, you have to use only these products and not these products, or only these tools and not these other tools? He just sort of started looking around, opening his mind, really, and saying, you know, what can we do? What are the possibilities? Not what has everyone done in the past, but what can we do in the future? How can we change? How can food evolve? And I think through, people say that he cooks with chemicals, and as he's quick to point out, he uses, for instance, a chemical called calcium chloride, which helps him he'll say, if I told you I was going to cook a whole fish in sodium chloride, you know, you'd say, oh my God, chemicals. But of course, as we know, that's common table salt. And calcium chloride is a different chemical that he uses for a different reason. But, you know, he says, why should you say calcium chloride is no good and sodium chloride is okay?
Well, you know, the thing that's so different, by the way, telling us about how he hates his molecular gastronomy, we interviewed Hervé Tisse, who came up with molecular gastronomy.
Yes, exactly.
And
yes.
Their perspective on why it's important are totally opposite.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Tisse is a very interesting guy, and he's a scientist, obviously a chemist, not a chef, but he did start very early asking the questions, the same kinds of questions that Ferran and some other people have asked, which is, I remember he said that he was following a recipe from a woman's magazine for a souffle, and it said add the eggs one at a time.
Oh, yes.
And that made no sense to him, so he just added them all at once, and the souffle didn't come out. Then he tried adding them two at a time. It didn't come out. Then he went back to adding them one at a time, and it worked. And so he quite logically said, why? What's the difference? And so that was the beginning of his career of investigating the science behind food.
But Coleman, he's up to something entirely different, aside from the celebrity side of it. And we discovered this when we talked to him. We talked to him in his lab.
He's
a Servetis.
But he's talking about Ferran.
No, that's actually Servetis that did that.
We're talking about that. But what he's trying to do is to figure out how to make food without having to grow it.
Right, without food. And which is, he did a dinner with... I think Pierre Gagnier.
Yeah, but the reason he's doing it is the most interesting thing. The reason he's doing it is because if you can figure out how to make food from chemicals without having to grow it, then you don't have the same boundaries about the amount of food the planet can grow.
That's right.
So if you're post-Malthusian in your thought process and you think that the world, once again, is in danger of going hungry, you have to have another way, and that's really why he's working on it. So the other stuff is fun. What he's after is some serious science with a totally different objective. But I had a different question. That's a digression.
Yeah, that's all right.
One of the things you clearly had to have in order to create this book was incredible access to the man everyone on the planet wants to meet. And who is incredibly busy.
Who does not even speak English, right?
No, he doesn't speak English.
So how did you...
Well, I'd known him, not well, but I'd met him on several occasions. We had mutual friends. I'd had lunch with him a few times when I was in Barcelona, three or four or five years earlier. He had invited me to come see his workshop, and he met him and his brother there. And so, I mean, I had some acquaintance with him. And then through somebody that's a very close friend of his and a pretty good friend of mine, Jose Andres.
Yeah,
from
that's how we got into Blue, too.
Right. And I said to him, look, do you think Farrar would let me write a book about him? He said, oh, I don't know. I'll ask him. And so he was kind of the middleman, and he went back and forth, and Farrar would say, no, I'm too busy. No, I'm too young. No, I'm, you know, this and that. And finally, at some point, Jose said to me, you know, the secret with Farrar is that he has to think the book was his idea. If he thinks it's your idea or my idea, he'll say no. But so let me be subtle and let me keep mentioning it to him. So he did, and eventually Farrar came around, and he said, well, come talk to me in Barcelona. So I did, and we sat down for dinner, and I think he wanted to sort of check me out and see how much I knew, and knew a fair amount about traditional Catalan cooking and also about French traditional cooking and Nouvelle Cuisine and so forth. And
well, you're an expert on Catalan cooking, are you not?
Well, I had written a book 20 years earlier. But I think he had a certain amount of confidence that I wouldn't be stupid about it. And so once he decided that, then it was come whenever you want. The first thing you have to do is come spend a week at El Bulli, and then, you know, after that, anything I wanted, really. And that when he first took me into El Bulli after we had decided to do the book, not just as a diner, but as a writer, he introduced me around to everybody, and he said, whatever this man wants, you know, wherever he wants to go, whatever he wants to look at, whatever he asks, you just cooperate with him.
Wasn't that kitchen amazing?
It is just amazing, and the organization, the level of precision is unbelievable. I said I couldn't believe it when I heard that before the service begins, they plan the menus out a year in advance. So he'll tell you, you know, next November 19th, this is what they're going to be eating. And I mean, it just seemed, you know, I'd never heard of that. And then I learned that sometimes if they were going to serve, let's say, spaghetti with pesto, because it's not always Spanish food, they would test three or four or five recipes for pesto to make sure they had the best one. For this is for the employee. And his point of view is, and it's something he learned from his first kitchen job, the chef believed the same thing, that you have to feed the people that work for you well, or they won't understand why they should feed other people well.
Now, he's nothing if not obsessive compulsive, right?
He's just absolutely, and he says, you know, it's all a matter of organization. And he said, you have to be very organized in order to be very crazy.
Now, I wanted to fast forward to ask you the next question. Does he like the book? Now it's done. What does he think of it?
Well, I haven't seen him face to face. That's going to happen next week since it's come out. And he doesn't, of course, he doesn't read English fluently, but he did read through the manuscript. He asked if he could, and he said, I'm not going to tell you to change anything, but just in case you have any errors or you have any dates wrong or anything. And I said, okay, as long as you understand that, because I can imagine there'd be a few things in here you might not like me to say, but he was good as his word, and he did find some errors I'd made and corrected them and didn't ask for any other changes, didn't say, no, that's not right or anything, and seems to like it very much, as far as I can tell.
I mean, that's pretty much his character, though, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I mean, I have to say, I think I was fair in doing the book, and if he didn't like it, I'd be sorry, but I'd have to say it's more important to me that other people like it than that he like it.
Yeah, I guess you've got a shaky ground when you're talking about Sati Santa Maria, huh?
Some of the shaky ground, yes, but that was, I was very lucky there because he told me to talk to a third party. He said he would say almost nothing about Santi Santa Maria, his kind of rival, or at least Santi thinks that they're rivals. And,
I thought you did that very nicely.
Yeah,
I thought
too.
It was it's been reported on from a much more hysterical viewpoint in other places, and we've interviewed Santi, we've eaten at his restaurant a couple of times, and there's really no comparison in terms of what's going on, so there's space for them both to be
doing what
they're doing, so for one of them to take a gratuitously inimical position just seems to be...
personality issue.
Yeah, it just seems to be totally out of order.
It is a personality issue, and it's, you know, as I explained, I mean, there's been friction for a long time, and I think Santi is a very talented chef, and he did some... has broken some new ground himself, not on the same level that Farrar, but certainly, as you say, there's room for both.
Now we love Carme Ruscalleda.
Uh-huh, yeah.
From Restaurant São Paulo, and she features in there as well.
She's in here too, right? Yeah, she's she like most of the other chefs in Spain are kind of step aside when the subject of Santi comes up, and Arsac and San Sebastian.
And I won't repeat exactly what he said, and it was not recorded.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me this. I'm going to ask you a question that everyone who's going to ask you, interview you about this book is going to ask. What about him when you got to know him was the most surprising thing to discover you didn't know before?
Oh, the most surprising thing. There were several things that surprised me. One thing on a very purely gastronomic level is there's a lot of kinds of food that he doesn't like, that he won't eat.
Like
he won't eat blood sausage, morcilla. He won't eat sweet peppers. He likes spicy peppers, but not bell peppers, or things like that. His brother, Albert, their mom told me that when he was young, he wouldn't eat anything that had tomato seeds in it. If there was tomatoes involved, they had to take the seeds out.
Okay.
That was as a young man, but a little less now. But Ferran has some things that he doesn't like, and he also says that when he's at home or when he's, you know, when he's eating, this wasn't exactly a surprise, but it was interesting the way I saw it demonstrated again and again, which is what he likes to eat is not somebody else's avant-garde food. I think he does that mostly to be polite when he has to. What he likes to eat is good ham or the simple grilled shrimp or something, the simplest, most traditional food. But he also makes the point. He said, you know, I don't go out of my way to every morning have the best bread within 100 miles and the, you know, finest butter I can possibly buy. Of course, I like good things, but I'm not obsessive about it. So he very, very firmly separates his professional and his personal life. He even says, you know, I'm very boring personally. Everything interesting about me is in my work. Now,
well,
that may not
happens.
Be true, but that's what he says.
Well, they say that about a lot of geniuses.
Right.
I mean, you can come to this conclusion, and I agree with you, that the thing that's outstanding about him is that he's truly a genius, don't you think?
I think so. I think he is. It's one of those things that it's hard. Somebody that just went there that I used to work for me at Silver Magazine had a very interesting comment. She said, I mean, it was a wonderful meal, and it was like a dream, but some of it seemed very familiar to me. And I said, you know, that's because it was not familiar until he started doing it, and now you've seen the second and third and fourth generation, or the imitation of the imitation of the imitation, sort of all over the world, and certainly in America. And so things that were just completely shocking or unheard of when he first did them 10 years ago or 5 years ago, now we sort of are beginning to accept into our expectations of what happens when we go out to eat. It's like when you talk about Wolfgang Puck and say, you know, do you realize that before Spago opened, you would never have pizza in a quote-unquote good restaurant? What do you mean? Well, I'm telling you, go back and look at menus, and it did not exist, and it's become so all-pervasive that we tend to forget, and I think with Ferran, that may be one reason why he's planning to close, as you've heard, and rethink the whole thing.
Yeah, what do you think he's rethinking? I mean, do you think, I mean, some people say he just couldn't continue this constant innovation.
Well, I mean, he says that. He says it's much harder to be original and creative today than it was 10 years ago. Now, but, you know, I have no doubt that down the line somewhere in 10 or 20 or 50 years, somebody will approach food and completely turn it on its head again some other way that we can't even comprehend. But in the meantime, I think there is something to that, and I think maybe he is smart enough to, as it were, quit while he's ahead, even though he's not.
Well, is that, I mean, that's what I'm asking, basically. Do you think that factors into this decision to close and turn it into what, an academy sort of, almost?
Well, yes, and I mean, but that's interesting because he says, you know, he's closing not until next year, but when he closes next, I believe he said June 30th, I believe, or something around there, sometime in the summer, he will be the last meal served at El Bulli as we know it, and then after, he'll take 2 years off, and then he'll reopen as a foundation with an educational facility. There will be some kind of food service, and it may be on the same level or even better than El Bulli, but it may be only for a month a year, or or it may only be for eight people a night instead of 30 people a night.
That.
But the other thing about that is he will tell you, he told me point blank, I know exactly what I'm going to be doing when we reopen. But I don't believe that, because the way he thinks, he will have, you know, 100 or 500 ideas between now and the time he reopens.
Well, what is
and I'm
he
sure
think?
He'll change his mind again and again.
I mean, what is he saying that he thinks he'll be when he reopens?
Well, he's saying, he gave me very, very specific, he showed me even a sketch he'd done, because he loves doing things with ink on paper, even though he has laptops and everything. He likes to sketch things out. And they showed me a kind of a map of what the place was going to be. would be like, and here would be, the kitchen, and here would be a library, and here would be a classroom, and so on and so forth. And he says it won't be a cooking school where you teach people how to cook or how to do his techniques, but it would be kind of a one-year immersion course in culinary culture and history and in basic ideas of taste and all kinds of things like that. And he would take professionals largely who already were in the business and try to bring them up into a higher level, and that would be part of it. And then he would have, as I say, some kind of food service. But he said, I might devote some time to serving breakfasts or to serving bar food or to serving cocktails that we created or different things like that. So he has all these different ideas, but I just can't help but think that he will end up doing something that he hasn't even thought about yet, because his mind is always working.
And one of the most interesting things, now, I think, did we say this already? Did we say it off the air? We both read this book from cover to cover,
yeah,
both Anne and Peter, and it's very rare that we would do that. But to me, some of the most fascinating parts of the book are the parts where the only reason you know that El Bulli is going to succeed at all is because otherwise there wouldn't be the rest of the book, and we wouldn't have been
exactly.
reading about it.
Exactly.
Because it's almost an incredible story, the struggle that they had in order to get to be open and to own the place, he and his colleague Julie.
Yes, and of course it started, it had nothing to do with him when the restaurant was opened. It started as a little beachfront bar and a mini golf course in the early 60s, and owned by a couple that was a German doctor and his Czech-born wife, and they built it little by little, and they loved good food, so they tried to hire good chefs, and eventually they had some very good French chefs. They had 2 stars from the Guide Michelin before Ferrand ever started working in the kitchen.
No, I can recall, curiously enough, the first place I ever heard about it was an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal.
Really?
And, of course, I never kept it.
Right.
But when Anne said she was negotiating with Jose Andres to try to get us into El Bulli, I said, I read about that. It's not exactly a shrine fine dining criticism, the Wall Street Journal. But I recall reading about it.
Well, especially since in the book you write that he loses money all the time.
Right, and that has been the history of the restaurant even before he was there, but certainly through the years he was there, when they would have it. I mean, you have to imagine now, today the road is still kind of frightening to get there, but in the old days before it was paved, it was almost impossible. And this is about 10 miles or so, 10 or 12 miles from the nearest town, on a little mountain road that kind of hugs the cliff overlooking the sea, overlooking the Mediterranean.
Scary.
And it's pretty scary today. And if you imagine that every time it rained, there were big potholes, there were no guardrails, there was no lighting at night, it's a wonder that more people weren't killed, sort of,
yeah.
Especially coming
down
after dinner.
I wasn't sure that we were going to get back. I mean, I really didn't. We were there in 2000, so 10 years ago.
There's a famous story about that, which has never been recorded, so we might as well record it now. Anne said,
okay.
why don't I drive back, Peter? You might be tired. So I said, I don't really think you're going to do that. And within 400 meters, she was fast asleep.
and we were
staying about 30 kilometers away.
Oh, my God.
I have to say, the drive back was easier because you couldn't see where you were going to finish up if you drove off the road, and you could
right.
see cars coming the other way.
If there weren't any,
it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, so there wasn't really anybody else around.
Coleman, a question. Do you...
Yes.
I mean, this is... Well, you reserve the right to not say if you don't want to, but you talked about the first generation, the second generation, so we're following Ferrand. Do you think anybody's as good in that vein?
Well, I think the best, this is a little, may sound a little invasive, but I think this is true, that the best chefs who have been influenced by Ferrand, or whether they've worked for him or just eaten his food, are the ones that don't copy him exactly.
Yes.
And I think...
like Francis Ghana, what's his name?
Massimo
Bottura. I think that he takes it in a different
way. I've never been to his place. I think Jose Andres has the possibility of really doing original things, even though he's reproduced a lot of Ferrand's dishes and kind of interpreted them for Americans. I think...
that guy in... Is it Abruzzo? No, it's Lamarque. He has absolute copies of the dishes on his menu. Who is that?
You don't mean...
Is it the crazy guy?
You don't mean Pisani in Umbria?
No, I think I can't bring the guy's name to mind now. Mm. He has a seafood restaurant, and it's about 10 kilometers south of Senegalia.
He does sushi. S-U-S-C-I.
That's the guy.
And he, in fact, he did work at El Bulli.
He did, but then he's replicated, and he considers it a tribute to
or something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, do you think, for example, that Alinea is like El Bulli?
Right, but he has some ideas of his own, and so does Homer Cantu, and so does Wiley Dufresne, and I don't think you can say that they're copying Ferran.
No, so it's springing off. I'm not asking about the copying so much as they're all going in their own direction. So this is not a dead end when he closes this restaurant.
No, I think that. But you know, Jose Andres said to me one night, "That's when we'll know how great Ferran was 10 years afterwards, or something, when we see how long lasting his influence was."
Oh, that's interesting.
I really think he has opened people's minds and encouraged them or made them see that it's all right to go beyond the common wisdom and the traditional things that they're taught. I think that's a very important contribution he made, rather than any specific techniques.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it shows up.
You're free to look for techniques, and you're free to, you know, try to do things people haven't done before.
It shows up in all those chefs at the San Sebastian area, I think.
Right. Oh, yeah. And, I mean, in all over Spain now. It used to be that it was pretty much limited, that adventurous cooking was pretty much limited to Madrid, Catalonia, and the Basque country. But now there's not a region of Spain, including the Canary Islands and Extremadura and places that you wouldn't expect it, where there are avant-garde chefs.
Well, Coleman, I think that we don't want to give away any further much more information about this book, because we want everybody to go buy it. But before we let you go, could you give us any indication of what this new project's going to be called, dailymeals.com?
Right, it's thedailymeal.com, and it is a website which will launch, the final launch, I will say, will be November 1st. And it is just going to be a mega site that will offer everything that we can possibly get onto it about food and drink, and it will have a very, very large and customized recipe database. It will have travel information. It will have some of the better bloggers out there, contributions from them. It will have humor. It will have a good sense of fun.
So you're going to draw in and link up a lot of other resources?
But there will also be a lot of original material, but there will also be links to all kinds of things, and we really want to be the go-to source for food and drink, and we're working very hard right now to try to put that together.
Like in publishing terms, like Gourmet Magazine,
or more.
Yeah. Oh dear, well, I look forward to that too. And apparently, you favor the latest crop of bloggers. Some of them are very excellent, aren't they?
I think there's some wonderful stuff, and I think, speaking as an editor, you know, I was originally was a little skeptical about a lot of the bloggers, because I know that they don't their prose obviously isn't edited usually or fact checked or whatever. But I found there's just tremendous energy, and the people that know what they're doing are really good. It doesn't mean everybody's really good, but you get a kind of personal voice, and really energy is the best word I can think of, that you often don't get with kind of manicured articles for a magazine.
Yeah, it takes a lot of discipline, because Peter started a blog, and the last time you looked at it was probably 6 months ago.
Well, you
do have to do it. Yeah,
I didn't spend enough time on it, and I guess there's enough time required just to produce this show. This is enough of our life's work already, and we think we're doing a great thing, because we're a vehicle for people to actually speak their minds in their own words, unedited. And we think that that's a real contribution. And
no, that is.
And we thank you.
That's kind of like a blog, an audio blog.
I think so.
An audio blog, right.
And we thank you so much for being a part of the program.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, and look forward to talking to you again.
All right.
Thanks, Coleman.
And stay with us while we take a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com.
Welcome back, and you're listening, of course, to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, And we're going to be moving on. I wanted to say one more thing about the Ferran biography. It's really difficult to write a biography that's acknowledging somebody who's so iconic in the moment. Maybe 40 years from now, somebody will be able to write a different book. Who knows? I don't know. Moving on, though, we're going to be talking to Chef Bertinet. If he were back in his native France, it would be Bertinet. And he's one of these really good soul people that we've met. He's talented, he's savvy, and he's at his heart very, very good.
And you can learn from his book, or you can learn from his cooking school, or you can learn from both, which would probably be the recommended approach. So here's Chef Bertinet.
It isn't every day that you interview a French chef who's living in England, who runs a cooking school that brings people from the United States and all over the world to visit and learn his wonderful technique. Richard Bertinet, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you.
Yeah, and of course, Peter's very proud because you're his countryman now. You've become an Anglophile, and of course he always has been.
And before we came on the air, I asked you why Bath, but please explain.
Well, I would say if you open a cooking school, you know, if you say Warsaw in UK, Warsaw, if you've never been there, it's not a very nice place, but Bath really ticks all the boxes. It's the kind of place where great countryside, beautiful architecture, lots to do all the time. There's a big airport with Bristol, so all our foreign customers can fly very easily to us. It's a good train link to London, so it's very central in UK. And it's the kind of place that everybody in the world wants to come to at least once. It's like Venice, really. So it's a great place to live in and to work.
Yeah.
It's a film set.
And aside from the fact that there's a wonderful cooking school and some excellent restaurants, there's absolutely drop-dead Georgian architecture that almost gives you an overdose. And a last recommendation for listeners, and you would echo this, I'm sure, is if you're going to Bath from London, please use the train.
Yes. No, the train link is so easy.
Sometimes the traffic jam is halfway to London and halfway back.
Yeah, the M4 is quite notoriously bad, especially on rush hour traffic.
Right.
So you can spend 6 hours on the motorway and an hour and a half on a train. So, yeah, the train is a very good link. It's a very good link from London as well.
Now, before we came on the air, we also said now the reason that you're on the menu program today is because you've decided to give all your secrets away so people don't have to come to your school anymore. can you explain that one?
Yeah, we're going to be talking, actually, with the purpose of the conversation, is your new book called Cook in a Class of Your Own with Richard Bertinet. And it comes with, it's a beautiful book. It comes with a free DVD, which further elaborates on your top tips and techniques. And you were a born teacher. Looking at this book, you're just a natural teacher, Richard.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for the compliment.
But you say that, no, the spirit is still there. Even if somebody gets the book, they're going to want to come to your school, right?
I think the problem when you write a book, I don't think you'd be honest with yourself if you didn't put everything you've got into the book. So that could be my third book, my first two were Dough and Crust. Well, I start to replicate with this one. It's only 55 recipes in the book, but it's all full of technique. And what I wanted to do is to get people to go back and enjoy their time cooking in the kitchen. So for rediscovering the pleasure and the confidence of being in the kitchen and having a good time and cooking with their friends, cooking with their family, and really just being a bit of a friend over their shoulder. So just looking over their shoulder and give them confidence for them to accomplish a nice dish, which is very simple, but we give them satisfaction. And then they can sit down around with their family and have a glass of wine and feel, hey, look what I've done.
Explain the origin and the function of these little sidebar Q&As, questions and answers.
Well, since we opened a cooking school the past 5 years now, there's always the same question popping out all the time from people coming to the class. So what we've done is to write down every class what question, what makes people tick, what is it that makes people worry about cooking, and from what's a pinch of salt, for example. And you'd be amazed how people don't understand what a pinch of salt is. There's a little pinch of salt and the chef's pinch of salt. And the art of seasoning makes your dish ready. So when people know and understand what they're doing, it's just confidence. It's a bit like driving. The more you drive, the more you cook, the better you become. So it's not a Michelin star book. It's not, but it's to give you confidence. It's really to reinforce what you know already and just push you along a bit more and just rediscover that hidden skill you've got buried inside you, I think.
I saw two recipes right next to one another in the book. They're both with lamb. One's a leg of lamb, and one's a lamb stew. Why don't we take those as examples, and then you can explain a little bit about how the different tips and techniques work.
Yeah. Well, the roast, just taking a whole leg of lamb for Sunday lunch, we leave now, we want everything to be pre-packed and all boned out and everything. There's nothing better than to have a whole leg of lamb that you roasted yourself on a bone, and then being able to slice it and carve it on the front of your hand or something. It tastes much better. There's so much more pleasure out of it. It's a kind of a primeval instinct of meat on the bone that we all relish. I think it's one of those pleasure in life, really.
I looked at the picture, and it looks exactly like the legs of lamb I produce on my outdoor barbecue grill with many of the same things included. But you have wonderful carving tips, because it's, even if you get it cooked right, you can still butcher the whole thing. If you're pardoning
exactly.
the pun.
Taking your time to cut through it and not panicking, really. It's a step-by-step thing. And if you miss one step, then you got to understand why you missed it and what's happened if you do miss it. And cooking the meat properly and understanding the resting of your meat, it's all those tips which just really will help you along when you start cooking. And the lamb stew, as you call it, in French we call it lamb navarre, or navarre d'agneau, but if we call it a French name, it scares people away sometimes. So we just call it a very simple, like a lamb casserole, lamb stew. But there's a lot of tips to get it right on this one. You learn a lot of knife skill, get your meat properly, and a pinch of sugar with your meat will just raise all the flavor of the vegetable and the meat as well, simply. Yeah.
I love the way you describe the vegetables that go in, and I think you started off with a small dice, and then later on you add the same vegetables but with a larger dice. But you have a picture of how to actually succeed in getting a carrot diced, which is not an intuitively obvious thing to be able to do.
When we teach knife skill, and it's just amazing. I always say to people, if you can slice and dice an onion properly, that's half of your cooking done. Because if you chop your onion, you don't even know how to put your chopping board properly secure on the board. You end up with your onion exploding on your board everywhere. It just puts you off cooking. So you just like going into a kind of a emotional trend, like, oh, I hate cooking. Oh, it's just, look at the mess I'm making everywhere. If you know how to do it properly, and it's all quite nice and relaxing, then you enjoy cooking. But if it goes everywhere, you start crying and you start cursing, then, you know, it's a bad start. So just really.
Richard, I just got some new knives that Wusthof just came out with, new technologically new, with a sharper angle and so forth. And, you know, they always say that a dull knife is more dangerous than a sharp knife. Well, let me tell you, I have lousy knife skills because I have not one but two major gashes on my thumb.
I said she was contributing a little extra protein to the dish, and maybe that wasn't an entirely necessary thing to do.
So knife skills are indeed important, yes.
It is. It's just confidence. It's the same with children. When we teach children at the cooking school, we always teach children with proper knives. So they learn from a very early age, from 3 or 4 years old, what the knife does. So it's very sharp. There's no point hiding the fact to a child that teaching them to cook with a blunt knife is more dangerous, I think, for my opinion, than a sharp knife.
Right.
You teach skill from very early age, and you get confidence there.
Now tell me this. I know you would have carried over a lot of your French techniques, because they're the gold standard of techniques in the world, and your cooking. Do you carry over anything else about French cuisine, especially you're from Brittany, are you?
Well, of course, from Brittany. I was born between artichoke, cauliflower and pancake, you know, and cider. So, and my seafood, of course. I love seafood. There's nothing better. I love to sit down with a big seafood platter, some nice wine and a little bread. Because seafood is just one of those, you don't have to do too much to it. And cooking with a lot of great sea salt, you know, the wet salt.
Oh, yeah.
And get all sweet potatoes and good mayonnaise. And that's all you need. You don't need anything else. And a lot of good fun around, of course. That's what makes a good meal.
I just read an article from Alain Ducasse is changing over his prize flagship restaurant to a new simple style. Did you read about that?
The big trend now is going back to simple. We've gone to the extreme with the fusion cooking and molecular cooking, which is fabulous. But for the chance people to do this at home themselves, it's a bit scary. But to go back to the good basic, the good, you know, what makes people tick. And what, if you ask people what's their best meal, was always something very, very simple. A good piece of meat somewhere special. It's memories. It's food memories that you put together, which make people really happy, really. And I think what we try to do is to, having fun in the kitchen and enjoying being in your kitchen and cooking something simple from your kitchen to your friends and family is one of the best rewards in life, because you get all your friends smiling and say, wow, that's really nice. The satisfaction you get from that, you can't buy that from a supermarket. Right. You can't buy it from anywhere.
On the cover of your book, you have a endorsement from Ruth Reichel. She said,
yeah.
Richard has inspired me in so many ways, a terrific teacher. Now, that must feel warm and good, huh?
When Ruth was at Gourmet Magazine, been a big fan of the bread side of our business, and they came down, Maggie and Ian from Gourmet came down and spent 5 days with us making bread, and they were blown away by what we were doing. And when I had a call 2 years later from Ruth saying, I want to come down, do some cooking with you guys, my jaw dropped, because Ruth is like, you know, even in here, you can't get bigger in the food world than Ruth. So when she came down, we had a ball. She came down with the actress Diane West, and we had an absolute ball. And we had fun. It was like two old friends cooking together, eating with our fingers, and really have fun around food. It was nothing fancy, but just really relaxing around the food. And we made the lamb, the crust on the top, and we did a gratin de finois, we did some Flemish, we did a lot of things. But very simple food, but we had fun, which was the whole point of it. And she was a great student.
Yeah.
Well, there are some great characters around you as well. Do you know Michael Caine's at Gidley Park?
Michael Caine, yes, he did a few classes in our cooking school. He's a real character and an absolute hero as well.
He does
for the Southwest and for the food down here. He's a quite inspirational guy.
And what about Raymond Blanc?
Raymond Blanc, Raymond. There's only one Raymond. Raymond is an absolute legend. I remember I heard of Raymond Blanc before I came to the UK. I was baking in a small bakery in the mountain in France, and a customer said, have you heard of Raymond Blanc in England? I never heard of the man, but they said to him, if you go to England one day, you've got to go to Le Manoir. It's an absolute beautiful place. And Raymond's got so much passion. It's incredible.
Oh, yeah, and he's so far ahead of his time all the time. I mean, years ago, when we were interviewing him, he had just instituted a cooking class series for children, which is now one of the hottest things going.
Yeah.
Now, do you do that too? Because you already mentioned...
Yes, we do children, yeah.
Tell me this, and people can buy this book, again called Cook in a Class of Your Own with Richard Bertinet, but they can also come and take your course. What is the procedure and what kind of offerings? How about a website, maybe, that explains the cooking?
Yes, our website, if you go on thebertinet.com, we simplify it, it's bertinet.com now, and you can go online, have a look at our, what we offer. And we do day classes, we do, a lot of your compatriots come on the five-day bread class or a five-day cooking the books, where we cook recipes from the three books and come and stay a week with us. We offer a big range, and usually if we know somebody from the state coming, they plan so well ahead. We're very flexible on the time when they come down as well. So I'm always amazed when somebody comes from Illinois, from Texas, from everywhere in your state. It's quite fascinating and so humbling as well, because the book's reaching so many people, and to make the effort to come all the way to us is fascinating. So I always give myself 100% to everybody who comes through our door.
Now, there's another guy I want to ask you about. He was the general manager of the dining room at the Bath Priory, and then he opened a restaurant in the, is it the county town?
Vito.
Vito.
Vito, is
it Scafidi, I think?
Yeah. He's got a small restaurant in Chippenham now, I think, with his brother or something.
Chippenham, that's exactly where we caught up with him.
Is that the last red and white?
Yeah, the last time we were there, we were trying to decide where to go to lunch. We were sort of in the neighborhood. And
yeah.
I had a little note that Vito had a new restaurant. So I called him at 11:45, hoping he might be open. I said, we're in this town that wasn't as interesting as we thought, and we need a place to go for lunch. Can we come right over? He said, come right over, and we had a wonderful time.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, you have a lot of good colleagues to play around with now and have fun, Richard.
It's all name-dropping. When you know people, right? You just call them at the bank and they always have. help.
Oh, dear. You know, it would be fun to come and see how your classes run. I must say that.
Oh, yeah. I've been to New York once, and I was so excited, and it's a fascinating country. I want to do, people keep asking me, when are you coming back to the U.S. to do a tour or something like that? So if anybody listens to the radio show there, please.
Please call them. Get them here.
I want to do a tour. I want to come back again. Any excuse to get back there.
It's fairly unique, New York, isn't it?
I mean, there's so much discovery. It's such a big country. So, New York is a... It was quite an eye-opener. I got very excited about it. But I always feel that there's so much to discover, you know, it's like any new country you go to. So welcoming.
Well, we're so delighted that we caught up with you today. You have a wonderful destination. You have a wonderful book. You have a wonderful culinary school.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We will be by to see you, maybe sure, and we probably will call a little bit earlier than 11:45 the same day.
I come to your class 9:00 in the morning, yes.
Richard, you've been a delight. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for having me. Thank you very much, and hello to everybody over there.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thank you. Bye.
And it's now time to take another pause.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. By now, of course, you know you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And to finish off today's program, a really dynamic young man whose name, nevertheless, is Old Man. He seemed to think he was an old man, but certainly he doesn't appear that way to us, and he has a very refreshing attitude to wine.
And lots of good information.
And a fascinating story at the end about BYOT. Not going to tell you any more about that. You're just going to have to listen and find out what BOT stands for.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Mark Oldman thinks he's an old man. Because he's 41 years old.
He sure is cute.
Yeah, he sure is cute. Looks cute. Yeah. Looks cute to me. He sure does.
Very, very nice picture on the cover of the book.
Sure doesn't like an old. Sure doesn't look like an old man to me. But then
Mark, the name of the book is Old Man's Brave New World of Wine, and is subtitled Pleasure, Value, and Adventure Beyond Wine's Usual Suspects.
And there's a lot of brave stuff going on here. But tell us about some of the bravery, Mark.
Well, I think about my friends, my mom, most of the people I know when it comes to wine, and they still hold up their hands and they say, well, you know, I know nothing about wine. So I think it takes a certain amount of bravery and motivation to kind of push yourself out of the usual suspects. Most of us kind of relegate ourselves to 3 or 4 or 5 wine types because they're safe. And it isn't the easiest to move beyond that, even though there's lots of opportunity in the world. There really hasn't been a book that kind of specifically curates a list of wines just beyond the usual stuff.
Now, you mentioned something uncomplimentary about Merlot and say this is where a lot of people are stuck.
It's true. I mean, you know, in the 90s, even before the movie Sideways got Merlot in people's minds, Merlot became very popular because when it's done well, it has a lot of what people are looking for, you know, medium to full-bodied, not too tannic, not a lot of astringency. When it's done well, I call it Cabernet without the pains. It's soft and it's smooth. But then it became very popular, and like, you know, many things in many fields, when it gets very popular, it kind of, to use the expression, it kind of jumps the shark and becomes overexposed, and then there are a lot of inferior versions on the shelf. And then, of course, you had Sideways firming that fact through Paul Giamatti and his character Miles, who said, you know, if anyone's drinking Merlot, I'm leaving.
But here you go. See, here's part of the magic of this book.
Right.
Because you quote Coach K, Coach Krzyzewski of Duke University and the U.S. Olympic team, and what he was doing when he accepted the job of coaching the Olympic team. He was drinking Merlot, particularly fine brand, I think, and eating
duck
pizza.
Duckhorn, I believe,
Duckhorn Merlot from California, and eating pizza.
Well, why don't we jump back to, like, who is this book written for and how is it organized?
Okay.
Okay, so first the organization, it's organized into 46 brave new pours. And these are lesser-known wines, either wines that are new on the scene or ones kind of worthy of rediscovery. And, I mean, it's for a very broad audience. It's kind of the book I always wished I had when I was starting out in wine, because usually there's this progression in wine where if you're going to drink a lesser-known wine, you have to devote, or you will have had to devote enough time to make wine a hobby. You know, most people love wine but don't have the time yet to make it a hobby. So I wanted to make the information extremely accessible and kind of tell people what the insiders are drinking. If you want to learn about Rueda or Chocolat or even almost famous types like Malbec or Gruner Veltliner, and you're not yet a connoisseur, you should be able to take advantage of that. What I will say is, you know, the insiders kind of have a parallel wine list out there. It's usually some wines that aren't that expensive but are lesser known. They're a little bit off the beaten track.
Now, did you do the wine picking, or did they do the wine picking, or was it sort of a combination of the two?
I picked the wines, and it was, you know, it's a really good question, because it's like, you know, how do you choose 46 types when there are literally thousands of wine types out there? So I wanted to kind of strike a balance. I didn't want to pick usual suspects, ones that almost everybody knows, unless there is a reason for it or unless there is a twist on it. And I didn't want to pick wines that were what I call Pluto pours, ones that are so arcane that you won't even be able to find them in your local wine store.
Right.
So it's like this middle ground from the almost famous to the surprising and surprisingly unfamiliar yet attainable. So what I did is I basically had, and I haven't really told anyone about this yet, but I had about 350 contenders and folders for each, and I just started writing the ones I knew I wanted in the book, and then as I kept writing, I started narrowing down which ones I knew I wanted in there, which ones were expendable this time around.
Now, you're using some expertise that you gathered over time, and the only thing before we came on the air was we found out that you were at Stanford University and you decided as a diversion you'd invite winemakers from Napa Valley down to present their wines to your tasting group, because this would be a way of getting to drink good wines without having to pay too much for it. But between the college and age 41, you must have been doing a variety of different things to do with wine.
Exactly. Right. My start came at Stanford when I started the Stanford Wine Circle, which was a club that brought winemakers down to campus. I actually thought we'd have to pay them, and instead these Napa superstars and Sonoma superstars and also the Central Coast stars were chomping at the bit to market to the next generation of consumers. So you're right. We had some amazing tastings. We'd call them up and beg them to come, and, you know, Robert Mondavi himself would say, well, I can come on next Tuesday, and do you want me to bring my $90 mountain-grown Cabernet? So we really learned a lot about, I really learned a lot. And then I started teaching as a hobby in New York City at a wine bar that happened to have an open room, and I designed the course. And then, so wine was a passionate hobby, and then I started a company called Vault.com, which is a consumer website. It's for job seekers. It's a portal. But the connection to what I'm doing now is I've always taken a very consumerist kind of, I empathize a lot with what the consumer goes through, with Vault it was through job seeking and getting really the insight, the good, juicy information on potential employers. So I ran Vault with my co-founders until 2007, and then we sold the company then, and then I could focus back fully on wine. But all along, I was writing books and teaching classes on wine. So I tell people my passion for it, there's real purity behind it. I'm not trying to sell wine in some capacity. There's no ulterior motive. I'm doing it because I really do love it.
Right. Now, help our listeners to understand how the book's put together, because that in and of itself is an explanation of that you can use as you're seeking truth in wine, if you like. If you're exploring for yourself, there's a method here.
Exactly. I divide the book into whites, reds, a rosé or a pink wine, a bubbly and then kind of a bonus section. And within each of those sections, I talk about these lesser known types, but again, ones that are still attainable. So if you go to reds, you'll read about reds from the Loire or Bargain Burgundy. Bargain Burgundy is kind of an area, everyone thinks of the Marquis, Chateaumont, the Rothschild type Burgundy, but 90% of Burgundy is actually quite affordable, and there are ways of kind of finding your way to those. Pinot from Oregon.
Hey, back to this Bargain Burgundy, and I'm looking at the page now, and there's a thematic graphic you use in this little boxed shaded thing.
Yeah, it's the Gartner Group Magic Quadrants, right?
That is
applied,
exactly.
Applied to wine.
Was it piece BCG, or maybe both used?
I think Boston Consulting Group might have started it, I think, and obviously every company that steered their guide was trying to head for the top right-hand quadrant. But then Gartner Group usurped it and is using it for technology. New York Magazine, of all things, uses it, and they have highbrow, lowbrow, and something in the different quadrants. So if you're looking at things you're really interested in, you look at the upper right quadrant, but in your case, you want to be in the lower left quadrant, right?
Exactly. And by the way, that New York Magazine grid, the high culture, that was really an inspiration, because that's the first thing I look at when I get my New York Magazine. And there's something about grids that kind of lay out the information differently, that get a different part of your brain working. And no one ever laid out a grid based on how much adventure a wine offers relative to its price,
which is where you are with that graphic. And then you have additional notes like audacious alternative to, and in this case it's a Pinot, right?
Right.
And then enthusiast also like, and then you list the wines, and then weight, and you have a scale there, a balance scale. Price, cheat sheet, what's that?
Cheat sheet gives you just, the chapters are designed to be pithy on their own, but if you want one extra pithy sentence, cheat sheet just provides an overview.
Okay, then label logic, bravely said, and that's, you pronounce the wines, right? And then you
that's
do
right.
Mark's picks.
Correct.
Also with. So you have that for how many?
46 different grape varieties.
All right, great.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, if you read this book, and then went to the wine store, and spent somewhere between $200 and $300, you'd get so much value you'd have already have paid for the book. because there's so much information packed in here, and then you have all the fun of reading what it is. Arend Degan said about Cahors. She said this wine is not for girls.
I really like that, and I love that it came from a woman and a French woman. It was just the perfect quote.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are quotes like this sprinkled all the way through. It turns out that musicians look like wine, and I think probably wine's like musicians. You have Julio Iglesias in there quoted frequently. I didn't entirely understand all the quotes from Dan Aykroyd, but I guess that's not really entirely surprising.
Dan was so funny, and I actually interviewed him in person. He's actually also involved in winemaking. He has his own label with the Boisset Group. And he's very knowledgeable about wine. One of the interesting things about that is he wanted to show that you can't judge a book by its cover in terms of who's a great appreciator of wine and who's not. Sammy Hagar, who was the front man for the band Van Halen, and kind of rambunctious guy, he knows his Domaine de la Romanée Conti and his fine Bordeaux. He was talking so knowledgeably.
Amazing.
That, you know, it's like you just don't know. It's almost like an invisible fraternity, those of us who are infected with unophilia.
Well, I tested this book because I spent my life on a mission not nearly as determined as you, not without putting nearly as much energy into it as you have, but searching for the perfect wine, which has a price point somewhere under $30, is an interesting new concept in what a wine will taste like. Probably ought to be red, although it doesn't have to be. This kind of exploration really makes it fun. So
well, he said.
So we had
fun doing this book. You could tell.
Yeah, but Charles Smith from Walla Walla, Washington, he's in there.
Oh, is he? Really?
Yeah, he's in there, and we met him at the Pittsburgh Wine Festival a few years ago, and he said he used to be a rock band manager. before he made wine, he just happened to grow up in France.
Well, look at it, B.R. Cohn, Bruce Cohn.
Well, yeah, but I picked it. Charles Smith's a little more obscure than
right.
B.R. Cohn.
Sure.
And then, the most surprising thing, and Anne right. didn't even get this far in the book, he has a chapter on sparkling Shiraz.
Oh, my favorite thing.
Which has to be just about the most intriguing wine experience.
It's startling to see it.
You know, I couldn't agree more, and let me tell you something, though. Half of the sommeliers I know poo-poo it. You know, I'll talk to them, but they're like, well, I don't drink that stuff. They'll act like it's a sugary white Zinfandel, which it's not. So that's why I love getting Bart Arahu, who, you know, makes the California cult wine. His wines often go for over $1,000 a bottle, and you know, he's lionized and worshipped in the expensive wine world, and I'm sure he drinks expensive wine, but he also likes sparkling Shiraz because of its berry charm and cleansing fizz. And it's like I tried to take a very kind of broad view and figure out, I mean, for $12 at a dinner party, if you serve sparkling Shiraz, which is a bubbly red, you are going to astonish people and probably intrigue most wine lovers, because most wine lovers have never seen it before.
Yeah, I was startled to see it.
No, that's the great thing. You have exactly the right word. It's astonishing. It will totally surprise people, because they'll expect something sweet and they'll get something dry.
It looks like Kool-Aid.
I used to serve it at weddings when I was first in Australia. Sparkling Bourbon, as it was called, was exactly that. It was cheap sparkling grape juice that was served at cheap weddings. But now people like Domaine Chandon are making it. We had at Greenpoint, the last time we were in Australia, we had lunch with some sparkling Shiraz from Domaine Chandon's Greenpoint, and it's going to catch on. Sparkling red is just so dramatic. It's going to be fascinating to see if California catches on to that. It wouldn't be so surprising to see Domaine Carneros doing that. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
Absolutely. Let me ask you, so in Australia they call it Spurgle. That's because that comes from sparkling Burgundy,
I think,
correct?
That was the original root of it, and it was, at the time, it was a cheap thrill sparkling wine. But
it's much finer now.
Now it's a refined sparkling wine.
The last time we were there,
it really belongs. But these listeners, these are the kinds of secrets which are in this book, Oldman's Brave New World of Wines. It's a fun read because it's so fascinating to read what these interesting personalities that Mark tracked down have to say. There's some very pithy observations, there's some very silly observations, but all of them, I think, add a lot of interest.
It's a really nice book. Good book.
And you've got a shopping list of places to go to get wines, which, as Mark said, his selection was based on the fact that you are going to be able to find them in your local wine store, unless you happen to be in Pennsylvania, in which case you might have some difficulty. But these are labels. These are the kinds of wines that we've been drinking, that on the menu's been drinking. We've been drinking Malbec, we've been drinking Cahors. We've been drinking Bergerac, incidentally, a variety of other appellations that I guess didn't make it into the book because he only had room for 46.
There's one I was going to ask if we had that he lists, I can't remember what it was called, from Basilicata. There's only one.
Agliano di Vultura.
Yeah, but he has it in this book.
Well, yeah, of course he has it in his book. He has Montepulciano d'Abruzzo in there as well.
Yeah, I saw that one.
And he explains that it's not the same grape as they used to make Vino Nobile di Montepulciano, which would fall out of the price range of the book.
Was that the Basilicata wines, the one that the guy gave us?
Yeah, he gave us an Agliano. But that's a different story.
You were trying to climb out the window. It was very dangerous.
Now you had a story you wanted to tell us called BYOT. So before we finish up, we've been on the subject of BYOB, which obviously is probably a way you like to dine a lot, would be my guess, so that you can bring wines like this if they're not on the list.
I love it. I love it so much. Although it's not very welcomed in New York, so you really have to pick and choose your place.
Right.
But yes, I do love it.
But you promised us a BYOT story.
Yes. Well, we were talking a little bit about truffles before coming on air. One of my favorite truffle stories, to fight the injustice of pricing in restaurants where here in New York you might pay, $60 extra for a few grates of truffle. So what I did is I had a lot of change. I had years of change, pennies, nickels, dimes, just collected and a box. I'm like, what am I going to do with this? And, you know, you can take it to a Coinstar machine, which converts all of that to dollars. I had $140 in change there. This was two Novembers ago. So I want to do something fun with this. I want to buy something I normally wouldn't have bought. So I found a wholesaler in New Jersey, a restaurant wholesaler, that traded in excellent truffles, and it was the heart of the white truffle season. And I ordered one knobby truffle that got FedEx to me. It was very exciting when it came. You could smell it through the box. It was that intense.
Oh, yeah, right.
So I called up five, you know, my girlfriend at the time and then five of my best friends, and I said, do you want to come with me? We are going to go to a local gourmet pizzeria, which we did, and which has very bland, you know, we ordered extremely bland pizza, and I brought a Barolo. I BYOB'd a Barolo, which you know is native from Piedmonte. What grows together goes together, proving that, you know, adage once again. And then ordered the pizza and then sneaked out, just kind of like quietly slipped this knobby, pungent truffle out of my tote bag. And by the way, I went to Dean and DeLuca to get a truffle grater.
You got the truffle grater.
Exactly. And the truffle grater, it's basically made of the same material that the $2 cheese grater is made of. But because it's used for truffle, it's like $45 at Dean and DeLuca. You know, it's like buying a tool kit for a Rolls Royce. Like, it's the same hammer, but, you know, because it's affiliated with Rolls-Royce, you're going to have to pay 10x. But anyway, so I slipped it out, and, you know, everyone at the table, you know, we had already poured our Barolo, and the restaurant was fine with this, but I was a little worried that bringing your own food to the restaurant might be like bringing shampoo to the hair salon, you know, like you're going to look askance at it.
People but do I that, too, by the way. Go ahead.
That could be a book in itself. But so anyway, I grated over the pizza when it came. I made it snow with fresh white truffle over the pizza, and we devoured it. We pounced on it. And then the waiter came over, and he said, hey, listen, is that white truffle you're grating on the pizza? And I kind of held my breath, and I'm like, yes. He's like, can I have a slice? All right, help yourself. So it became just a decadent Barolo and white truffle night, and we paid far less than we would have in a fancy restaurant in New York where you would have gotten one or two, you know, grates of the truffle. So a goodly time was had by all, and thus, I, you know, was my first time BYOTing.
That's great.
Very good.
It's clear that you should have drunk Barolo with it. And I think that's a great way to end. On the Menu is off to Toscana, and we're going to drink some Brunello Montalcino in the next couple of weeks, and we'll bring some of the story when we come back. But in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on the Menu, and listeners, you got to get these Oldman guys' books. They're really packed with information, and they're fun too.
Yes, thanks,
well,
Mark.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you. You're one of my favorite shows, and I just had a great time with you.
Well, as I said, what makes our job fun is all the fun and interesting people we get to talk to.
And you'll find more of them in the same time, same place next week. So we look forward to having you join us then. In the meantime,
bye-bye.